This is a podcast from meow.net.
Meow!
Meanwhile, in an abandoned warehouse.
Welcome to another episode of Meanwhile in an Abandoned Warehouse. Today I am actually joined by Sophie Hope, who is in London while I'm in Helsinki. My name's Owen Kelly, and today we're going to follow up our conversation, or at least my half of our conversation from last month, where I looked at some of the things that Cory Doctorow had to say about copyright and about enshittification, the process by which everything gets worse. Now, one of the things we looked at briefly there, and we've looked at before, was the question of copyright, which in the end comes down to the question of how do people get paid for their creative work? There are basically two ways of payment, aren't there? One is you get paid by the hour or the week or the day or whatever, but you get paid a lump sum for your labor. And in classical Marxist theory, you get paid less for your labor than your labor is worth, and the rest of it becomes profit. Now, that's one way of getting paid, the standard way of getting paid under capitalism, if you like. But there's another way, and that's the way defined by copyright. And that's where you get assigned a right to something you've created and get paid every time that work is shown or reproduced or distributed. And that's the way in which classical music composers, pop composers, authors, film directors, etc. get paid. Now, that's a question that we need to look at, or we want to look at. And Sophie, do you have anything you want to say about that to start with?
Hi, Owen. I would like, as well, in this conversation to bring in the question of co-creation, because that's where I guess my head's at the moment, thinking about what happens if authorship is shared, particularly in the context of social practice, socially engaged art, community arts, those areas where there is an intent or an ambition to open up a process for others to be involved in. So there's some kind of desire, at least ethically, morally, to share authorship. But what happens, it's a question, I don't have all the answers, I don't have really any answers, but a question is what happens to copyright in those contexts?
Right. Well, one of the things that started this discussion when Sophie and I were asking ourselves, what should we talk about this month, was the fact that Bill Willingham has released the copyright of Fables, or at least claims he has. Let me take a second to explain this to those people who don't know about it, which might be almost everybody listening. Now, Bill Willingham is a comic book writer, and he launched a comic called Fables 21 years ago. And this has had 110 issues so far and a couple of spin-offs. And the basic underlying notion behind the idea or whatever behind the series is that various figures from folklore, from the world's fairy tales, are in fact real people who live in a secret society in New York. And the internal struggles and intersections between the various members of this secret society and between those members and the mundane world are a source of continual drama. Now, historically, the comic book industry has operated under something called work for hire, where comic book writers, comic book artists are paid a hourly sum, a weekly sum, or a sum of money per page. And they receive a one-off payment according to their contract, and the work, when handed over, becomes the property of the comic book publisher. So historically, the creators of Superman had to sue DC Comics to get any compensation when their work became the cornerstone of a multi-billion dollar industry. In Marvel Comics, Jack Kirby arguably created most of the characters that Marvel Comics were built upon. Fantastic Four, Spider-Man, the Hulk, etc., Doctor Strange. And he also worked on a work-for-hire contract, and in later life became embittered by the fact that his work had been stolen from him with very little compensation. Now, during the 80s, comic books became willing, comic book publishers became willing to look at a different form of publication, the so-called creator-owned comics. These arose when popular comic book creators went off and started their own independent publishers and achieved a level of success that the traditional comic book publishers hadn't expected. Therefore, in order to entice them back, comic book publishers began to offer creator-owned comics. And that's what Bill Willingham thought he was getting into when he launched Fables. Fables is a DC comic, and DC is now a division of the massive entertainment conglomerate Warner's, which is in turn part of the Warner Discovery empire. Okay, you might say, how does this work? Well, DC is part of a comic duopoly. Its rival, its only major rival, Marvel, is a division of Disney now, after a series of mergers. So Willingham set out a contract with DC, and he regards them as acting under bad faith after a change of personnel. And he said that he wanted out of the copyright, out of the contract, and they said he couldn't. And so he said, in that case, as the owner of the intellectual property, I will place all of the Fables mythos into the public domain. In other words, I will relinquish all copyright control over it, and anyone can do anything they want with it. Now, in response to this, DC made a rare public statement. They said, "The Fables comic book and graphic novels published by DC and the storylines, characters, and elements therein are owned by DC and protected under the copyright laws of the United States and throughout the world in accordance with applicable law and are not in the public domain. DC reserves all rights and will take such action as DC deems necessary or appropriate to protect its intellectual property rights." Now, it's true that the characters in Fable were all actually based upon public domain characters to begin with, but the specific versions of those characters in the series are still distinctive and copyrightable. For example, the Big Bad Wolf is one of the main characters in Fables, but in Fables, he's known as Bigby Wolf. And Bigby Wolf has specific characteristics which are much more tightly drawn, as it were, than the loose bundle of characteristics that the Big Bad Wolf has. So that's the current situation there. Bill Willingham claims he's relinquished copyright on the work, and DC say you don't have the right to relinquish that copyright. Mm. So we find ourselves there at an interesting impasse that he wants to get rid of the copyright, and DC is saying, no, you must retain it because we also retain it.
Do you know where things are at now?
Well, the situation now, I think, is a traditional standoff that will only be resolved if a third party decides to take Bill Willingham up on his offer.
Yeah, I see that. It'll kick in.
If you and I decide to write a set of Fables novels or find an illustrator and create a new series of Fables comic books, then there will be undoubtedly a court case where DC claim we're in breach of copyright and we bring Bill Willingham in as one of our expert witnesses who says it's not in copyright anymore.
Mm-hmm. And then it goes down into the nitty-gritty detail as to which bits are and which bits aren't.
Well, also, in fact, I think the other missing part in this conversation so far is the precise contract that Bill Willingham signed.
Yes.
Because he argues it gave him sole right over the intellectual property. And there have been contracts signed like that in the comic book industry. There are characters created by writers or a combination of writers and artists who are removed from one comic book company and placed in another one because the creators own the copyright.
And does that mean they get paid every time there's a, animation made for TV or something with that character?
Yes, yeah. Precisely. And that's where the initial conflict came from. Mm. Bill Willingham said that DC had authorized and arranged a video game based on the characters in Fables.
I see.
And he was not informed about this, and he was not remunerated for it.
I see. Yeah.
He received no royalties from it, and he had no input into how it was developed. Mm-hmm. And he said that that breached his agreement. But he's not actually published the agreement itself, so it's difficult for anybody else to say categorically whether this is true or not.
Yeah. How does this relate to Creative Commons licensing? Because that's something I've tried to do with things I've put out there in the world, published or works that exist in the world, these material expressions. If I have a choice to and a kind of right, I feel, to license them, if anything, I'd go down the CC route. And obviously there are lots of different types of CC licensing. But I guess that is, do you know if that's something that he has done with the Fables?
No, the purpose of the Creative Commons licenses is to loosen your hold over your own copyright, isn't it? So that the reason to have a Creative Commons license is because either you want anybody to be able to remix or mutate or build new artifacts on top of your copyrighted work, or you want people to be able to do all of that as long as they don't make money out of it, or you want them to be able to do some of that or not all of it. So you can have a Creative Commons license that allows people to reproduce your book infinitely, but not to rewrite it. Mm-hmm. Or you can have a license that allows people to do both.
Yeah, but I'm saying, because I guess somebody like us, we're interested in cultural democracy and how that relates to the commons. Creative Commons licensing is a manifestation in a way of trying to have genuine open access and share and share alike principles in the work that we do. So it's a very, I guess it's more on, if there's a spectrum, it's more on the copyleft rather than the copyright philosophy of working in the and being in the world, but I guess, you know, so for somebody like Disney to kind of operate on a CC basis is kind of unthinkable, because it doesn't, I guess it doesn't chime with their business plan and the way they think about what they do as which is much more about the ownership of the things that they produce and put out there in the world so that they can make more money from it. So it's kind of a philosophical position as well, and a political position as to where and how you license what you do.
I think there are several things I could say about that. Well, I agree with you, that's the case. But I also think there are areas where copyright breaks down or softens. Traditional copyright breaks down or softens. And Creative Commons licenses can help that, but some people manage to do it without Creative Commons licenses. One area is fan fiction.
Mm.
Phenomena like J.K. Rowling's writings, the world of Harry Potter. There's a large fan fiction universe around this where people write fiction about Harry Potter and the various characters and new adventures without any intention of ever making money off it. And they circulate it in internet forums and the like.
Mm.
The same happens in science fiction, where people set up universes, like, for example, the universe of Dune, or The Hobbit, the universe in which The Hobbit lives, Middle Earth. These almost invite, by their very nature, other people to come in and say, oh, I'd like to write a story like this, as does the universe of Star Wars or the universe of Star Trek. Now, I wonder what would happen if they went back to see the Tribbles again in Star Trek. Questions like that arise, and someone sooner or later writes a short story and circulates it. Different copyright holders have different attitudes towards that. Under a Creative Commons license, you could say precisely at the outset what your attitude to that was.
Yeah, yeah.
But under a standard traditional copyright license under the Berne Convention, you don't say that, but authors adopt different attitudes. Michael Moorcock, the science fiction writer, fantasy writer, in the 1960s and 70s created a character called Jerry Cornelius, and he created him specifically with having his friends write other Jerry Cornelius stories in mind. So he created Jerry Cornelius and then handed it out. This was before the internet, so whether other people took him up on it and we never heard about them, who's to say?
Yeah.
But he deliberately created that. It was copyrighted, but he said, effectively, I'm not going to enforce my copyright on Jerry Cornelius. But the problem that with that as an arrangement is it has in brackets, unless I want to.
Yeah, exactly, because I have.
So with J.K. Rowling's fan fiction, there was a point where she hauled back and said, I don't want this. And then people were shocked and upset because previously she'd been entirely tolerant of and even covertly encouraging mm-hmm. it. And then she rolled back again and said, oh, well, maybe it's all right. But there you can see that you're acting under her unspoken boundaries.
Yeah, exactly.
She will decide what you can do, or she may actually decide what you could have done and say, you shouldn't have done that, take it back. So I think that's an area where certainly Creative Commons makes explicit what standard copyright doesn't. There's also another area, which if I can come back to that, which is the notion of copyright orphans. Denise Troll Covey wrote a book in 2003 called Copyright Permission, Turning to Dust or Digital. And in that, she said that approximately 95% of the books ever published are still in copyright. But fewer than 3% of the books ever published are still in print. And that means 92% of the world's books are neither generating revenue for the copyright holder, whether that's you, me, or Disney, nor easily accessible to potential readers. Now, that also has obvious problems. There are books you and I might want to read. I have an interest in late 19th century, early 20th century detective fiction. And I can hunt for some of that on Project Gutenberg and other sources of old, out-of-copyright literature. But some of it is still in copyright. And some of that copyright is held by people who nobody knows who they are, which is what copyright orphaning is.
Okay.
So imagine that the copyright is still in place, but nobody knows where the author's children went or who inherited the copyright from the author's children.
Mm.
And now we're in a position where we want to publish that book or I want to find a legal copy of it, and we can't do that because nobody knows who to ask for the permission to publish it. Now, under Creative Commons licenses, you can get around that. And this comes up, an example of this occurs in a book called I Collage, Therefore I Am, which is written by Kembrew MacLeod and Rudolf Kunzeli. And they describe an event which took place in 2004 when the Indiana University Press withdrew from circulation copies of a book about a relatively obscure and dead composer, female composer, Rebecca Clark, because the copyright holders of Clark's compositions intimidated the press. They said that you do not have rights to, under copyright law, you do not have rights to reproduce this. Mm. Now, Leanne Curtis, who is the editor of a Rebecca Clark reader, believes that the quoting of this work in a scholarly context didn't violate copyright, because the alleged infringements added up to 94 lines in a 241-page book.
Okay.
But the university lawyers, as university lawyers often do, wanted to play safe.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't prepared to risk it, and they weren't prepared to risk it over a relatively small circulation book about a relatively obscure female composer. However, had the book seen the light of day, it would have been one of the very few of a disproportionately small number of scholarly works dedicated to female composers, a group whose work has historically been eclipsed by that of their male counterparts. So the copyright actually worked to censor a work, and actually worked paradoxically to make sure that Rebecca Clarke was less well known than she would have been had the holders of the copyright in her work embraced this book.
Yeah.
So arguably, even they were cut, even they lost out of that.
Yeah, kind of when you're talking about university legal procedures, it reminded me of the ethics processes, which I guess are tied into that broader legal responsibilities and parameters of how universities operate. But something, again, going back to kind of a very minute world of community, socially engaged, participatory practices and in the arts and research, the ethics procedures you have to go through to try and encourage and convince universities that co-creation is something you aspire to and that you're trying to involve people from the very beginning, that your process of working is conversational, informal, about relationships. You know, these like fundamental ways of working with others is so hard to get through the system because of that it's almost like it doesn't recognize that way of working, whether you might be opening yourself up for, I guess, legal action to some extent if things go wrong. So it's almost, you know, like it prevents a lot of this sort of practice happening because of the legal structures, and like you say, the university's not wanting to take risks in those areas. There's one thing wanting to try and work in this way, to share information, to share research processes and things like that, but really difficult to do in practice when you're in those systems.
I'll just add there that I think that historically, co-creation has always been a difficult area, not just for ethics but in universities, but also for copyright.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because copyright is essentially a property right, and property rights become easier to enforce the fewer property owners there are. If you own that house, then it's easy to know who owns that house, and it's easy for you to transfer your right of ownership of that house to somebody else. If 21,000 people own that house, it becomes a nightmare to establish that all of the legal ownership has been properly transferred. Yeah. I give those as two extreme examples, but historically, copyright has always been given to as fewer people as possible in a work.
And I guess that leads on to that thing I wanted to talk about around co-creation and what happens practically in that process. I found a website called Nolo, which is a legal advice website, an American one, so it might not completely tally, obviously, with legal structures in different places. But it's got something on the process of what you might do to draft a joint copyright ownership agreement. The things you need to consider in if you're setting out as a group to co-create a work, something, a project developed together. There are a set of questions they suggest you ask, they suggest quite difficult questions to have at the beginning, but worth having in order to clarify what joint copyright means. And I guess it's also always from experience of working on projects that are heading towards a kind of, at least a sort of an attempt at co-authorship, but it never really fully gets there because of the structures of universities and the art world, which end up being tied back to individuals. But the so they talk about royalties. How will money be allocated between you and your co-creators? Are all revenues split 50-50, for example, or in other ways? Secondly, how will costs be allocated between you and co-create and the co-creators? So, for example, if you're making a movie, who will rent the cameras, hire the actors? How will these costs be split, 50-50 or not other ways? Thirdly, control. After the work is created, who has the ability to decide how it's used? So that goes back to the, for me, the kind of CC licensing angle of it. For example, if your band makes a song, must decisions to license it be unanimous, or may one of the members of the band make that decision alone? What decisions must be made unanimously and what do not require unanimity? And then fourthly, sale of rights. What if one creator eventually wants to sell his or her rights to the work, in the work? Must the other co-creators approve the potential purchaser, and or do other co-creators have the right of first refusal to purchase those rights? And then finally, credits. How will the co-creators be credited when the work is publicly performed and displayed? Will all names be listed and so on? And in what order and with what titles? Will this same listing remain in effect even if one co-creator sells or licenses his or her rights? So obviously it's very context specific, all of this. And there may be other things to consider. But I feel like with certainly the sort of work I've been exploring and doing around co-creation is that these conversations aren't necessarily had at the beginning of a process. Because of the, I guess, the type of work I'm looking at and researching, there's a paradox at the heart of it still, that because we're basing the commissioning process, the discourse around social practice, for example, is still very much based on the idea of the artist leading or being commissioned or invited in to begin with. And of course, the way the industry operates at present is most artists are really precariously employed anyway. So any chance to recuperate some money from that process is probably well needed. So there's all sorts of bigger questions around how to do this well and ethically and transparently, I suppose, to have these conversations. If somebody is really trying to and interested in co-creation, what does that look like contractually, practically? It's been quite useful for me to think about that, even if it doesn't end up in a set of concrete fixed things, and obviously every situation is different. It's just useful to have these questions in your mind about, like, what if we produce a performance that then is toured? Who's going to be paid for that? Who's involved in that? How are we crediting people?
It's worth pointing out though, Sophie, that the use of Creative Commons licenses is a separate issue, in the sense that Creative Commons licenses merely define how work can be distributed and what other people can do with your work, and what you as a creator, and when I say you as a creator, you might be a band or an orchestra or an entire community in a village somewhere, but what you as a creator will permit third parties to do with your work once you've made it public.
I guess that's why it kind of makes sense to have that discussion. If you are in the business of co-creating, you decide collectively whether you're going to use a CC license or whether you're going to want like different type of licensing for the thing that you produce and that then's distributed. It's a group decision, I guess. It's not just you can't make that decision on your own about how the work is distributed.
No, I think you've hit upon something which is an important hinge, as it were, between ownership and copyright. Because if the Creative Commons license says what third parties can do with the work according to the copyright holder, all the questions you raised a second ago that you need to ask at the beginning of the project still apply. Because even if the copyright holder is a band, then the band has the question. The band's questions about who has permission to do what. Can I sell my part in our copyright to you? Is not answered by the Creative Commons license, if I understand them correctly. They just assume quite reasonably, that that there is a creator, and that creator may be more than one person, but the Creative Commons license itself doesn't legislate for the in terms of the relationship between the creators.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's on the material thing. It's the song. It's the book. It's the thing that's material expression, the work itself, I think, that you license.
Yes.
And so, yeah, I know. Yeah, it's the. But I guess then that's what's useful about those questions about asking in a process of collectively working together. One of the many things you have to address if you're a band or whatever is, what are we going to do about licensing the things that we produce? Are we all okay that everyone's, it's a share and share alike, or do we need to be a bit more like hard line and go down the copyright route for each of us? And do we share that? Does somebody have more, like, I guess that was quite interesting, the analogy of film. Where was it? The idea. So in this book, Dear Images, Art, Copyright and Culture, edited by Daniel McLean and Carsten Schubert, that I've had on my shelf for some time, they say, in the introduction, copyright ownership is distinct from physical ownership of the work because copyright protects what is intangible in the work. In addition, multiple copyrights can exist in a single work. For example, in a film, individual copyrights may protect the film itself. So that's the artistic work, the spoken word, the literary work, the script, the dramatic work, and the soundtrack, the musical work. So I guess, again, you kind of think, what kind of copyright do I have over what? Am I the songwriter? Am I the stage manager? Am I, you know, like what ownership do I have over this? Yeah, it sort of was quite useful. The film analogy helps because it's often, you can't have, it's not a one person band, it's not one person making the film. It acknowledges, I suppose, that there's multiple owners and authors of the process, which I don't think we have in like visual arts, in the socially engaged art world, from a visual and performing arts perspective yet. Maybe we do in some contexts, but not necessarily the ones that I've been looking at and trying to get my head around. Not to say it doesn't exist in their world. And we'd be interested to hear from people who have that experience of co-creating contracts.
Let's wrap up there then, Sophie, shall we?
Yes.
I think the important issue here, which started with admittedly something which is not directly to do with the commons or our usual area of interest, was Bill Willingham's announcement that he's removing Fables from copyright and putting it into the public domain, and DC Comics rejoinder, oh no, you're not. That, I think, raises issues, and it does raise issues which we're beginning to think about co-creation. And as Sophie's pointed out, the co-creation issues are at least in two parts. One, what to do about the final work, and the other, what to agree on at the start of the process about how ownership of the final work will be divided. Okay, on that confusing note, let's say goodbye.
Thanks, Owen. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. Now that you've heard the podcast, please go to the website. There you'll find much more details about topics talked about, links to references, and much more. You can find the website at miaw.net. That's miaw.net. See you there.